Betsy, Alan, Gil, and friends, happy that you came out tonight. Thrilled to be here. I'm Hung Shur, as Gil said, and I'd like to say just a word about kind of what's going on tonight, put it in a context, and then describe what we're going to do, our idea of how this program will go tonight, and then talk about this first song. Buddha Dharma has actually been in this country for a century. The Jodo Shinshu first came to San Francisco and started the Buddhist Church of San Francisco 100 years ago, 108 years. And so we've had a century of filtering down to the roots, and the fact that tonight could emerge organically with Japanese Zen, with American Vipassana from the Thai tradition, informed by the Thai tradition with Chinese Chan, I think is significant. We're going to be bringing forth American Buddhist songs, and guaranteed that some of these harmonies didn't exist before 2 hours ago, because we never sung them before 2 hours ago. Brand new, so you're all part of history in the making. So hopefully these songs will put a Dharma seed in your heart and a smile on your face. I'm going to offer a couple songs. Betsy will offer two. Alan will offer two. And then we're going to do that again. So you'll all have a chance to hear from all of us. And throughout the songs that we're going to do, we're going to be talking about, each of us from our own particular points of view, what the significance of what we're doing tonight is. The title was Dharma in the Music, and Music in the Dharma. So American Buddha Dharma has now matured to this point where it can take this expedient expression, this form. Our world is full of music, and bit by bit, our minds are becoming saturated with Dharma. So that the two of these come together is a very natural progression. That's what we're about tonight. I just wanted to say that for me to be here sharing with these two friends and musicians is really an honor for me. In the East Bay, is it significant that the three of us all come from Berkeley? I'm not sure.
I'm sure there's nothing to do with it.
Or not. No, probably not. How significant? What could that mean? But in the East Bay, if you're doing anything with a social voice and a voice of conscience, Betsy Rose's name will be on the program. She, for years, when we were marching towards Iraq the second time, Betsy went down into the BART stations to sing her mind and to bring people back to their hearts. No anger, but mindful. Real Dharma music. Alan, people know about Alan's history with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship and also his teaching at the Berkeley Zendo. What you don't know is this is the rhythm guitarist and one of the main inspirations for the Bluegrass Intentions, one of the Bay Area's premier bluegrass groups for years now. So, and Alan at one point was editor of Sing Out magazine.
I just found that out tonight.
Yeah, that's quite astounding. If you were an old folkie like some of us, Sing Out was the Bible. That was the voice. So for me to be here, kind of a Dharma singer wannabe, it's really a thrill. So. This start out with a song called, it's called The City of 10,000 Buddhas. This City of 10,000 Buddhas is a monastery in Northern California that's the heartbeat of my association. And at one point in my life, I did a pilgrimage that was aimed at City of 10,000 Buddhas. It took me 3 years to get there. And this song was written on that pilgrimage in a very difficult time, I might add. There was a period where every night we would go, myself and the other monk would wind up in a laundromat to wash the eggs and the beer and the orange juice off our robes. We called, when they poured orange juice on it, we called it an offering of orange juice without benefit of cup. So we were regular customers in the laundromats up and down the coast highway. So anyway, so this song came out to keep me on track and to keep my mind aiming into the City of 10,000 Buddhas. So. 10,000 Buddhas. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Started with the vow to bring enlightenment to every living being. From the sage who brought the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha to America to build a new foundation. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Founded on a vision of the proper Dharma flourishing again. It's a place for cultivation. It's a place for transformation of the common one to a bodhisattva. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. The city's home to Guanyin Bodhisattva, compassionate, enlightened one who contemplates the sounds of living beings. With 1,000 eyes to see them and 1,000 ears to hear them and 1,000 hands to rescue them from suffering. City's home to Guanyin Bodhisattva. You can join me on that line. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Ooh, sounds good. Instilling virtue in the children, filiality is number one. They will vow to get enlightened, to repay their parents' kindness, to repay the great compassion of the Buddha. Here we go. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas again. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. It starts with care for aging people, filial behavior in the home. When the family is happy, then the cities will be peaceful, and the nations and the worlds will come together. It starts at City of 10,000 Buddhas. Here's our line. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Enlightened to the Buddha nature, perfect and complete in everyone. He's the sage who vowed to save us, to show the road to wisdom, return the light, wake up Turtle Mountain. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas again. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. Making Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, sages from the likes of you and me. And the virtue of the Dharma carves our greed and hate delusion into precepts, to samadhi and to wisdom. Three times. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. It's called the City of 10,000 Buddhas. That's it. Can we all room together next semester? That sounds really good. Okay. You all know the story. The Buddha was living in a pleasure dome. His father was afraid that the first sight of impermanence would wake him up, and he wouldn't become King of India. So he tried his best to keep him in the delusion that an SUV was his proper birthright, you know, or stable of elephants at that time, I guess. So, and that everything was meant to be fresh and new always. So as our story goes, and thank goodness, the Buddha went down to the city gates and on three consecutive days saw old age, sickness, and death, and it stopped his world. It was a shocker. And then on the fourth day, he met a monk. He met a cultivator. Now, there was no Buddhism in the world at that time, right? The Buddha was not yet the Buddha. But he saw a cultivator. He saw a Vipassana meditator, someone who made, made practice part of his day. And again, the Buddha stopped to consider that this might be a doorway out of what he had just seen, which is the inevitable end of a human life, which is death. So that sight of the monk giving him a possibility of transcending birth and death propelled him out of the palace. So this song is the night before he left, the moment before he left. He's leaning over Yashodhara, his wife, saying goodbye. She's asleep, and he's made up his mind, and he's on his way, and he's telling her his heart before he takes the step that turned him into the Buddha. He loved life. She was fine and she was fair. And when he said goodbye, he said to her, Yashodhara, look at where life leads. Yashodhara, I'm gonna try to get free. I took a little trip into town. I learned that death will cut us down. I woke up by the city wall. Freedom to die is no freedom at all. Yashodhara, look at where life leads. Yashodhara, I'm gonna try to get free. Like you, I never heard an old man sigh. I never knew that people die. Like you, I never heard a sick man moan. I learned this body ain't my home. Yashodhara, death is haunting me. Yashodhara, love won't set us free. Controversial line.
It's very un-American.
Wow. Even un-Christian. Then I saw another man who walked in robes with bowl in hand. His gaze looked neither left nor right. His brow was clear, his eyes were bright. I asked him what he did all day. He said, I cultivate the way. I watch my mind, I watch my breath, and in the end, it's life and death. Yashodhara, I couldn't love you more. Yashodhara, that's why I'm walking out the door. Some will say that I'm a fool, and some will say that I'm too cruel. This is the best thing I can do, and when I get free, I'll come back for you. Yashodhara, look at where life leads. Yashodhara, I'm gonna try to get free.
I thought you were going to go next.
No, I thought you were going to go
next. Oh, I'm going to go next. Oh.
Is that okay?
Well, but I'm happy to go next. Well, I think I'll start off with a song that was one of the first consciously Dharma songs that I ever wrote. And I was introduced to the Dharma by Thich Nhat Hanh, and I was much younger and very uninformed about the nature of Buddhist practice. And all I knew was that there was a gathering for artists that were being invited down to Ojai, and I was invited. And I knew that Thich Nhat Hanh was very renowned, and I'd read a few of his books. So I was very excited to be part of this auspicious group of artists to be together for 10 days at Ojai. And my image was that we would meditate a little and do a lot of art. And we would have late night poetry readings, and we would sing under the stars, and we would hobnob and network and all this stuff. So it was a great shock to find out that it was a silent retreat. I was way far from home, and I had carpooled, so I couldn't leave. But it worked out incredibly beautifully, because really it was about 3 or 4 days of silence. And Thay kept saying to us, you're going to get a chance to make your art. You're going to get a chance to share your art. But first you need to be silent to get down below the habitual layers of art making, you know, and all of the consumer compulsion, all of the competitive compulsion, whatever is going on, to just sink down so that when you create, it will be from a place of freshness and newness and authenticity. And so that's what happened for all of us. And when I came out of that silence and began to write, I began to write music that I had never written anything like before. And one of the things that he inspired us to do, and that's how this song came to be, was he said, find a way to express the Dharma in the form and language of your culture. Don't try to look and sound and dress like a little brown, you know, brown-robed Vietnamese monk. Be an American and find the American Dharma. And that was permission. So I created a bluegrass version of the three promises, the three treasures, the refuges, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So, can you help me out, Alan?
Maybe?
All right. Some of you know this, and we'll learn it together. It goes like this. Before that was basically, I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the radical shift, Sangha. These one-note shifts that you really waited for, you know. So I was really relieved when I saw him tapping his toe and smiling. And And he invited me to come with him to some other retreats where there were children, Vietnamese children, Vietnamese families, because this music turned out to be a bridge to the younger generation and to children of Vietnamese parents who were growing up speaking English and wanting nothing more than to be American. And this funny man who spoke their parents' language and talked about what, you know, mindfulness was a bit of a hard pill for them. So this singing helped a lot. So let's do it again. You can all kind of just get down a little bit here, kind of hoe down. You can tap your toes and you can sing loud too. It's done. Here we go. I take refuge in the Buddha, the one who shows me the way. Have grown up, to what extent I have grown up in the Dharma, at Spirit Rock, first through Thich Nhat Hanh and then at Spirit Rock through the family program there, which I've been involved in since its inception 10 or more years ago. And so I've just grown up with a very unorthodox form of this practice, because when you're working with children, you just don't do it the way grown-ups do it. So it's a very lively experience there, and we sing rousingly in this big, beautiful, high-ceiling meditation hall, and it's very resonant, and the children dance, and we do all kinds of skits and plays and songs. And so I always feel very taken aback when, for example, when Gil introduces me as a Dharma teacher. I have to be the least formally educated, formally trained, transmitted person who could ever be called a Dharma teacher. But I think that what I understand is that the Dharma is a very natural wisdom. It is a very natural knowing that we have about the nature of life and love and reality and self and other. And people who have the good fortune to let their artistic expression be cultivated and get to become, to do this a lot, express the Dharma without realizing it, because artists have that freedom and that permission to just let the images come up, let the words and poetry come up that are really seeking for truth and seeking for that clarity that is so much a part of our practice. So it's really thanks to my long years of being a songwriter, which I started doing when I was very, very little, that I think the Dharma was able to come in and mingle with that music, because already the songs had been going in that direction without my ever knowing the name of it. So I want to do a song that comes out of my family experience. The song for the Buddha's wife is so interesting, because one of the things that women often struggle with is that this image that for the Buddha to become enlightened, for anyone to become enlightened, you have to leave your family encumbrances and go out as a lone monastic. And for many women, this is just not an option. And I'm happy to find and to say that Dharma is everywhere in family life, everywhere. And one doesn't have to leave your front door except to run screaming out into the night sometimes. But other than that, you don't have to go anywhere to get a complete teaching. And anyone who's a family person, I'm sure, knows what I'm talking about. So this is a family Dharma song about attachment and desire. my child Matthew was a baby. I could take him into any store, and he would just lie there in his little whatever seat and just look around with this kind of, that wonderful, just taking it all in, no names for things, no desire. And I remember when I saw that shift, and it was probably about a year and a half, when instead of just, it was like pulling things off shelves, you know, and it's like, it's inevitable, it's going to happen, there's no way to prevent it. And then we spend the rest of our lives working with that, learning how to occasionally let go. So this song is called Can I Have It? Matthew wants a choo-choo. Matthew wants a ball. And Matthew wants to stay up late and watch the stars that fall. Matthew wants a story. Matthew wants a song. I would give him anything I didn't think was wrong. But we're driving down the highway on a silver summer morn. And Matthew wants the car keys. Matthew wants the horn. So I'm trying to change the subject. I point up to the sky where the clouds are dancing in the wind. Holds his hands up high. He says, have it. Can I have it? Can you bring them down, down to the ground, Mommy? Can I have it? Now Matthew chases butterflies. He tries to taste the snow. Wants to catch the bubbles, all those big ones that I blow. Those golden flowing rainbows just beyond his hand. But when he finally touches one, he doesn't understand. And he says, have it. Why can't I have it? Oh, it runs away when I try to play. Can I have it? Upon my breast, the magic of today, and
I'm lucky just to hold you, my little flake of snow. I hope my hands can open when it's time to let you go. And I can love you, just love you, as I watch you fall.